celebrating success, learning from legends, and growing poppies. This is Tall Poppy Talk with Grace Lewis. Kia ora and welcome to Tall Poppy Talk. Today we have Hannah Heidevelt. She joins us for a special episode diving into a lot of things, but mainly into the factors affecting mental health for elite athletes, how we successfully push through the wall, and the physiological plus socio-physiological elements of low energy availability in sport. Hannah herself is an elite athlete. She has an impressive history of national and international championship medals to her name, including 2 gold medals at U23s and getting 2nd at the Olympic trials. Crazy. The intention of this episode, we're going to focus not only on Hannah and her accomplishments, for which there are so many, but we're also going to utilize some of this time to talk about her learnings and make it an opportunity to pay forward some important discussion on the subject of low energy availability in sport and mental health. Hannah and I are teammates, well, we're teammates, so this is something we talk about a lot just in life, and I think it's really cool, an opportunity to put that on a podcast so other people can listen in. Regardless of if you are an athlete, quote unquote, I truly believe that this conversation is transferable to everyday life too. We know the words burnout, imposter syndrome, feeling tired, all of these things. And so I hope you can take something away from it. But Hannah, welcome to Tall Poppy Talk. My first question is, where and how are you today?
Hi, I'm good. I'm back at home in the Netherlands. I have been spending winter break with my family, so it's been good.
Your accent is very American when you're speaking English. Can you talk to me through where this American accent comes from?
Yes, I was born in the Netherlands, and then my mom is American and my dad is Dutch. And then I went to the US for university. So I've been speaking mostly English for the past 4 years.
Very cool. Thank you. I know some listeners will be like, that's not a Dutch accent. It's because Hannah is a woman of the world, which I love. But yes, you are back in the Netherlands right now. And before we started recording, we were just saying, okay, in essentially a week, you're coming back to the States. It's into Florida training trip time. And then it's spring racing season, which for our listeners who either aren't familiar with rowing, which is fair enough, or aren't familiar with how the state's kind of athletic collegiate system works, spring is where like race time really begins, especially for rowers. How do you feel heading into that?
Yeah, I feel like training is, yeah, just like high volume. A lot of it has been on the erg recently. I think I've been humbled a little bit with like the amount of erging. But I've been alternating a bit with running and cycling as well.
What does that mean, you've been humbled? Is it harder than you were anticipating?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I think I used to be a bit better at, like, erging for many weeks in a row. I don't know. I just sometimes, well, like, you go through, like, ups and downs a little bit with training, and I think erging is, like, a very important part of the sport, and it's, like, it's part of it, and it's, like, a data point. And you keep, like, you know, you keep getting more data points as you do it more. But I would like to see more data points on the water. I'm ready to be back on the water. So, yeah, I think that's the update on my winter training is, like, I've been putting in the work and I'm ready to wrap it up. But it's still January, so, yeah, here we are.
That's when we'll bring up Femke's quote again of medals are made in the winter. I think that just shows your mindset of, yep, you know the value in it, but I'm ready to get back onto the water because, I mean, you fell in love with rowing, and as much as we know erging is an essential part, we all love rowing more than we love erging. Unless maybe you're a CrossFitter, CrossFitters seem to enjoy that. But sorry, I've taken us down a tangent, so let me get back on to it. When we're thinking about this capstone project that you're working on, obviously I know more about it. Could you first just give me the title? At least the working title of this capstone project.
It's Mental Health and Elite Female Endurance Athletes, like, Performance.
Thank you. Such a powerful title that I'm sure you spent a lot of time narrowing down and working with the US Rowing Sports Science Director to get. To take a step back, why do you care about the subject, and then what led you to pursuing it as your capstone project?
Yeah, I think my own experiences in rowing and, like, the challenges I faced and the pressures, like, It's just a topic I think I've learned about and I care about. I'm in my own journey, like, by doing this capstone project, I am not an expert by any means. Like, I think I have a heightened awareness of my performance and my recovery, like, when I'm doing well mentally versus, like, when I'm not doing well mentally. And I've learned a lot about the physiological part of it, parts of it, through this project, and also the psychological parts and, like, the gaps in research as well. I think it's, a really interesting field.
So interesting, and also so much unresearched areas. Like, again, I'm coming from a very much, I'm not a STEM person at all. I did not study STEM. I was communication, political science, that sort of stuff. So my own caveat of I should fact check this. But, and all that said, there's a lot more research and study done into male autonomy, like biological male,
physiology.
Thank you, physiology, of male athletes and endurance athletes. And a lot of that research, while some of it is transferable to female athletes, a lot of it is not, because there's so many different factors that contribute to just the female autonomy and everything else. But when you talk about the mental side, I remember, so a little story of realizing, wow, if my mental game is on, it really does impact and benefit my physical performance. Of there was only one time I did a seat race where I was ready, where they called my name. So a seat race, for those who don't know, is in rowing, one of the best ways to compare or to decide who's faster is you just swap one person from one boat and one person from another directly, and then race the same distance, ideally like 1 kilometer or something. So then you can ascertain, oh, this person made the difference in a way. And we could get into that, but just take my word for it that seat racing is how we determine who's faster. And most of the time I would be like trying to avoid eye contact with the coaches when they would say, pull the boats together, we're going to swap, because I'm like, please no, like I can't handle that pressure, because it's so much pressure on that one person, right? However, near the end of my like final season, I was just so ready to show what I was capable of, because that mental side, I'd been working on it with a sports psychologist, like, and then I was like, please say my name, I'm so ready. And just that, and then I crushed that seat race, because that mental switch from, oh, please don't pick me, I'm not ready, I don't want to do it, to then having a strong mental state where I was like, okay, even if I lose the seat race, that's fine. Then the other person is faster than me, but I'm pretty confident I'm going to do well. And so that was just one experience where I realized, and unfortunately it was near the end of my rowing career, but wow, if you have a great mental state, which I'd put a lot of effort into, like intentionally working with the psychologist once a week, which is a privilege that I could do that, but how much that correlated to my physical performance, because external factors didn't have as much of a say as how confident I felt internally. So the fact that you're studying this, and that's probably a part of it, I can just imagine how many internal wins it's giving you and aha moments as you're talking to different people, right?
Yeah, for sure. I have really enjoyed doing research on this topic and talking to different people and reading and rereading research papers. Like, it's definitely like I've been reflecting on like current experiences and ones in the past and the different boats and environments I've been in, like a lot of aha moments, like you say. And yeah, I think like realizing that like other people, and also people in different sports, experience the same thing.
What you mentioned too about being in different boats and different environments, another part of that is I would always say the boat, and I raced in fours primarily, right, was we are the first four, we are the fastest four. If we go out and have the attitude that we are the fastest four, I know manifestation and affirmation, these are all words that are thrown around, but my understanding of affirmation is saying to yourself, no, I am the fastest four, and then you act and conduct yourself in a way that is like that. I know Justin's quote that I do enjoy a lot is, champions act like champions long before they become champions. So breaking that down, you act and behave in a way that, okay, maybe I haven't necessarily achieved that thing yet, but I'm conducting myself in a way as if I am going to. And you just move with so much more confidence, and you don't doubt yourself quite as much when you're really confident in where you're going. And I know I'm rambling a bit there, but I think to your point about being in different boats and environments, when you have a teammate who has that energy, it just uplifts you and it motivates you. And so not only are they making themselves faster, but they're having that impact on other people and sort of lifting the average standard of the environment. So I just think it's really impactful, not only for you, but for your teammates.
Yeah, I agree. The champions act like champions before they are. Like, that quote is a really good one. That one has been coming back a bit more this year. So that's really cool that you mentioned it. You know, there's a certain maturity and confidence. And yeah, and I think like doing this research, like I'm just realizing like kind of my weaknesses as an athlete. And I think that's just growth and just like good to learn from, because I've had some success like here and there. Like, that doesn't mean I'm like always doing things perfectly. I have more goals in the future. So just gotta keep climbing.
I love what you say there too about you've had successes, because you have. I mentioned it in the intro, but getting second at the Olympic trials this past year, that's huge, especially for your age. So it's huge on its own, and then you add the age as another layer, because it shows by the next Olympic cycle, you're going to have so much more experience, refined technique, fitness will just continue to grow. It's really exciting and motivating. But the part you mentioned too about, okay, there's things you do wrong potentially, or areas you can learn from. I think sometimes with anyone who's seen success, so outside of sport or in sport, sometimes we have correlation or causation issues. So what I mean there is you could be crushing it in work, and there's something that you're doing that potentially isn't really good for your mental or physical well-being, but because you're seeing success, oh, well, I'm getting my promotions, I'm getting my work done, you confuse these habits that you're forming, like, oh, clearly these must be working. It's like, well, no, maybe you're able to be seeing success, but if you actually, you know, did some reflection and then change some of these things, like get more sleep or move your body, or I don't know, see a therapist, whatever it is, like work on that mental side, you might even see exponential gains. But it can be really confusing when you are seeing success to just go, oh, I must be doing everything right because it's working, instead of thinking, okay, things are going well, but could they be going better? It's really hard, I think, projecting here. It's hard to take that moment and pause when you are seeing success, because in your mind it's working.
Yeah. Yeah, this reminds me of kind of how I like fell into my low energy availability state roughly a year ago, a little over a year ago. And it's, yeah, because of that, I had a PR on a 2,000 meter piece on the erg. So in rowing, you have 2,000 meter erg tests and 6,000 meter erg tests, as we both know. And so, yeah, I had a really good piece. I PR'd on my 2K, and I felt like that usually, like, logic says, like, oh, like, training is going well, like, you PR'd, you know? And then I kept training, and then, like, you know, like, 2 weeks later, I did a longer test piece, the 6,000 meter test, and that did not go well. And, yeah, I think a good term for what happened is, like, I hit the wall. I ran out of energy and glycogen stores, and yeah, I didn't really know what happened at the time. I was just like, yeah, I don't know, like, I'm just out of energy. Like, I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what I did. I didn't really know what I did wrong. Like, to your point, I think, yeah, I PR'd on, like, one piece, but, like, generally, holistically, like, training actually was, like, not that productive. Like, I was just, like, kind of just hitting a wall and just, like, always just, like, doing a lot of volume and, like, working really hard, but not really recovering as well. So, yeah, that's kind of how this, like, project started, is just, like, my own drop, my own experience going up in training volume at Orion. So, yeah.
I appreciate you sharing that story, too, because if I recall, afterwards was when you had a winter break time, right? So this was when you could allow yourself time to sleep and maybe fuel and reflect, because you had a bit of a break in training. Was that right?
Yeah, yeah. So it was right before winter break, and I went home for 2 weeks. So my doctor advised me to cut my training in half and then eat a lot of food. And so because I was home, I had more control over my training, so I could focus on, like, replenishing my energy stores and, like, eating and sleeping better. And also just like feeling normal again. Like my mood was just like way off. I was having a lot of mood swings. I was not sleeping well. Like I was not like just doing well. Like I could really feel like my energy systems were just like off. Yeah, it was a very interesting experience. So I was really lucky to get a break for roughly 2 weeks and have like more control over my training and to get back to like a normal place, because I didn't know, but I was actually fighting low energy for like a while, having trouble like finishing training sessions. So having an opportunity to like pause and like reset. Yeah, because the longer you're like in a low energy availability state, like the longer it takes to like recover. So I had been in there for a few weeks, maybe like I was paving the way towards something called relative energy deficiency in sport, which is called Red S. And so it wouldn't take me a day to recover from low energy. No. Like it would take a little bit longer, a few weeks. And so that's pretty much what happened.
Thank you for bringing up Red S as well, because quick side thing, what I think was really a gift for you was going from the 2K to the 6K test, both of which, might I add, are horrendously hard, but they're like, you get such an adrenaline, like they're such an experience for a rower to have. Anyway, that's just a tangent. However, for you to go from the 2K where you saw such success, like that personal record, to then the 6K, having that happen in such quick succession, I think was the value, because had the 6K happened 2 months later, you would have just chalked that up to, oh, training's not going well because the 6K. But because you'd had a PR and then a really tough time, you were able to identify like, oh no, there's another variable involved here, because how did I go from so good to so poor that quickly? It can't just be my overall training. And that's when you land on the energy availability. But the part two about Red S is when I mentioned earlier how a lot of stuff isn't studied, or is in the early stages, the infancy stages of really being delved into with research. There are a few pioneers in like women's autonomy in general, but women's athletes who are saying like, yeah, Red S is one of these things with that, if you're not familiar, common symptoms are no menstrual cycle, low energy, tired, like all the things that your body's craving more energy, so it can't operate, and it kind of shuts down some of those systems, because something like a period's like, that's a lot of energy for your body to produce. And I think, unfortunately, and this is speaking from my experience, it's quite common for female athletes to just, oh, well, that's normal because I'm training so much. That, and then you have doctors who say like, well, no, actually, that shouldn't necessarily be the case. But the general narrative when I was particularly starting out was, oh, that's just kind of common and it shouldn't be. But that just shows that there has been a shift, which is good, and recognizing like, no, if you fuel correctly and really monitor and are aware of how much energy availability you have, all these things can hopefully still function. But something to point out, which I think you and I have both had the value of experiencing, was at least when I was on Rucker's team, there was 90 people on the team, and all of us respond to training in different ways. Like a lot of us were living together, eating very similar, doing the exact same training load, but seeing really different results. And it was such a cool moment for me to experience firsthand, wow, not only is the amount of energy you put into a training going to dictate the results you get out of it, right? Like we know if you give more, you'll get more. But it just shows that for some reason, some people are capable naturally of more in terms of energy availability and some people aren't. And you can't look at your neighbor and be like, oh, well, they're doing this, so I should be able to do it too. You've got to really look internally and be like, well, it doesn't matter if Hannah can do this, or, you know, Georgia can do this. What can I do? And I have to like focus on myself rather than others. So sorry, I know I rambled there, but that was just all the stuff you've been talking about is really interesting to me. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it is really interesting. And I think it's also just like very relevant. Like I think women's sports are like rising, and like there's more and more women who are just like really like raising the bar, even just like personal records. And then that coupled with women in sport becoming more vocal about like mental health, like Simone Biles, like, you know, what you said about being on a big team with like a lot of other teammates, we do respond to training stimulus differently depending on like at what point in the cycle, like menstrual cycle we're on, and like how we're eating, our stress levels, like what's going on in our personal lives, like school, like, and then some people are better at handling it. Some people can manage some fewer hours of sleep. Some people do not, and then get a cold, or then a cold maybe develops into something more extreme, like who knows. Like, what I find especially inspiring is when successful women, like, vocalize their struggles. Like, I find that very empowering, especially when it's an individual sport. Simone Biles, like, she has her own point system. I don't really understand gymnastics completely, but you have your own point system, and then she has won, like, many gold medals. I think it was, like, one bronze, but everything else was gold. There's something unifying about vocalizing it, your own athlete, with, like, results. But if you share, I find that so powerful.
Exactly. And something, too, that is relatable, not just to sport, but across the board, is you feel this nervousness of, if I do take a break for my mental health, or if I need to, you know, cut my training in half, people are going to move on, the system's going to move on, and I'm never going to be able to catch back up. When in reality, if we use Simone Biles as the example, she actually took a step back, focused on her mental health, and then came back even better than where she was. But we do have this sense of, oh, if I stop now, it's like a current in the ocean or something, it's going to move away and I'm going to be left behind. No, you're not. But I just want to really acknowledge for any listeners, like, that is a normal feeling to fear, oh, if I slow down or if I stop, I'm going to just lose too much ground. But that's not the case. You'll actually come back better if you genuinely take the time to improve and focus on your mental health as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, as athletes, like, we're meant to, like, get really comfortable, like, being tired and being in an uncomfortable, tired state. And yeah. So it's hard to, like, distinguish, like, okay, now I'm, like, over the line. I'm not recovering anymore, and this is not really productive. And it's challenging to be like, I now need to take it down a notch. I need to find more opportunity to recover. And yeah, who's going to tell you, like, is your coach going to tell you, oh, do less work, like, da-da-da, you'll definitely get better if you do less work. Like, that's a really hard decision to make as a coach, I think. I can imagine, I'm not a coach, but yeah, I think that more is more mentality is very relevant for elite athletes with really ambitious goals.
Yeah, the more is more. And I'm going to jump to a different question and then come back to yours, but because we're kind of in this topic already of overtraining, I'm curious for you, what is your experience personally, and then maybe what you've witnessed with others?
Training. So last year, I took a year off school to train full time with Orion. The training volume is a lot higher, like double, triple sessions. And we went up in volume as, like, over the course of the fall, I will say. Like, in the beginning, we eased into it a little bit around November, December, like, in a small boat doing, like, 23, 24K. Like, that was, like, a new concept to me. That was, like, a different level. And so, yeah, my experience, like, I would just be very tired after training, and I would first, like, take a nap or do something else and then have energy to make food and eat. And that's when, so then I'm not really recovering on time for my first session, and then I'm not really eating enough for my next session. And so then basically all the time, the second session is, like, pretty darn difficult to do. You know, you also kind of just enjoy training less because you're tired, and then you think it's normal because you're meant to, like, you know, train to get more tired and recover. But, and I had some ambitious goals last year. And so over winter break, like, cutting the training in half was actually not what I wanted to do at all. I wanted to train more and, like, get better. Yeah, so that was tricky. I think it was, like, the good call. I would have made it worse if I trained harder. Like, I needed to take a step back. The rest of the year went really well. I managed to PR again on my 2000 meter test, and I had a really solid 6K. I went to a winter speed order, and then Olympic trials, got second at Olympic trials, and then kept training, and then I got invited to go to Henley with Team USA. I had a really good year. And then had a bit of a dip in December, January. And then in terms of other people, I trained in a really small group last year. So, and I also wouldn't really feel comfortable calling anyone out. But I think in general, what I've noticed is, like, rib injuries. I feel like just near the end of the season, I notice, like, teammates tend to have, and I've also had one myself, either, like, a rib flare-up, you could say, or you, like, fracture your rib. And there's a couple of different things and different, like, versions of a rib injury. Like, you could kind of row through it, or you're out. But I'd say, like, near the end of the season, when people are just, like, really tired from, like, all the racing, I think just being near the end of your season, like, your reserves are kind of up, and then you're just more prone to injuries.
Like, it sounds funny to say because we're very young, but in the college season, those of us called 50ers who stay on to row, because college is 4 years, so we stay to do a fifth year. Like, increasingly, those of us in the fifth year are just so much more worn down. I'll say that because that was me. Because our bodies, like, we've just been doing this for so long now that naturally, to your point, it takes a toll. And so you're only like 22, 23, and my back's always sore in this. And my rib injury is interesting. It was like, again, not a STEM person. It wasn't the rib itself wasn't fractured, but it was like it would pop out. There was one that would like come out because the cartilage wasn't like holding it in place. Or again, I don't know how that works, but all I know is the athletic trainer would push it back in and it would hurt. It would make you feel like sick in this. But once it was back in, it was fine. But over time, it would kind of pop itself back out again. So to your point of the various rib injuries, and for those non-rowers, just watch rowing and you'll understand why maybe the rib in the back gets sore, just because that motion constantly, like even if you're doing it perfectly, you're still going to get fatigued and sore, and injuries will happen just because it's such a repetitive motion. Before I go into the question about what, like really diving into what low energy availability is and like how that shows up, I just want to talk about the Olympic trials for a second. For you, and without getting into the imposter stuff yet, because we'll talk about that too, but just in that moment of the Olympic trials, I know as a teammate, we were so hype to see you there, but what were some of the emotions you were feeling at the start and then at the end of that trial race?
Good question. I remember feeling like very excited to be there, and then humbled to be racing people who had been training at the Princeton Training Center and who had been to Worlds before, like Senior Worlds. Like, I still haven't made my like the first like my first senior team yet. I don't know when that will be, but like I looked up to like everyone that was at the start line. I was like, this is hype. Like, this is like, these people are really good. And I remember like afterwards that people would say, oh, good job, Hannah and Hannah. Just like that camaraderie, like that was also like, I was very grateful for that. It was really cool to like race them.
Thank you. And the pier too is a type of boat where there's just two people and you have one oar each on the left and the right side of the boat. And you have to be so in sync and aware of the other person, because if you're a few centimeters or millimeters uneven with your oar height, then the boat's going to lean one way. Like, it's such a intimate pairing to be in a boat with someone that, to your point about learning a lot, you just have to become really in sync. And when you get a good peer partner and you can learn all those things, it's really awesome, like a special experience. Okay, swapping back to more of your capstone study, the academic part, and then I want to finish on the tall poppy imposter syndrome question. But take a step back, when we think about low energy availability, what is that and how does it show up in sport? And sort of open mic for you to get academic on us.
Low energy availability is when an athlete is underfueled and the demands for training are insufficiently met. One can become overtrained and experience like a decrease in performance and mood. And the way this shows up in sport is like an athlete restricting their eating relative to their training. Like, you can go up in volume and then the dietary intake does not go up, which can be unintentional or intentional. So one can adopt unhealthy eating behaviors or patterns to improve their efficiency in their sport or to achieve like a certain body composition. So in endurance sports, this might be like more leanness, but low energy availability can also happen in other sports, but I've mainly focused on endurance sports in my research. I was reading research papers on swimmers, cyclists, runners, rowers, but it can really apply to like any, also just any person, just like background. Within sport, energy is going down because there's like, you're training so much that your body just has enough energy for the training and then not anything like aside from training. So like, physiologically, your body is giving up things so that you can finish training. And so at the elite level, like, usually people don't cut corners. So chances are, like, when the volume is going up, athletes will finish the training at whatever cost. And then fueling will be, like, on the side. Like, okay, that will come.
Too, when you've said the part about unintentional or intentional, the way I have come to understand it, or at least, like, my perception, is some unintentional ways could just be time. Like, if you, and again, athletic or not, if you don't make time or prioritize it or meal prep or whatever it is. Maybe you've just got a really hectic day or couple of days, and unfortunately getting proper nutrition just falls to the wayside. Or some unintentional impacts could be like economic. So a lot of athletes typically in rowing, too, or endurance sports, unless you're getting sponsorship, like it's not exactly a high revenue area. So maybe you just cannot afford to be consuming as much food. I know that that's a bit of an experience with, at least in New Zealand, some of my friends who were really struggling to find work, or they had to work part-time, or they were studying part-time and then being an athlete full-time. Yeah, not necessarily having enough financial stuff to eat super well, which is unfortunate. And I think a lot of programs are trying to make sure that that's avoided, but it's a reality. And then the other part you said about body composition, I think it's hugely unavoidable, this idea and topic to be introduced, especially with female athletes, of like social media and the influence and impact it has of trying to be an athlete, achieving these crazy feats, like physically, and then also trying to conform to an unrealistic body image, right? So as much as you want to be a focused athlete and have that as your goal, you're inherently still going to be impacted by some social pressures and norms and stuff. So I just think, I'm curious, has that come up in your conversations and in your study, the impact of social media and social pressure?
Yeah, it has. Initially, it wasn't really a topic I was going to explore in my research, because I just felt like there was so many other like symptoms to like discover. Like I was like, social media, I don't know, like, but then it came up a lot. And so that was interesting. And so yeah, what I found out from my experts, like talking to them, is that there is a certain like ideal body type for like endurance sports. And so the more competitive, ambitious athletes will like strive like that body type. And then also like all athletes have like some type of body dysmorphia. And yeah, and I think social media kind of like brings that out. Like it really kind of highlights people, and it can make people doubt themselves and identify their own weaknesses. Social media just has a way of putting value that. But then what I also learned, the brain doesn't choose what it focuses on.
What does that mean exactly?
I didn't get a whole lot of detail from this part. My interpretation is that what you pay attention to in your sport and like the things that like matter to you and trigger you, like you don't really choose that. Just your brain. It's just neurology. Right.
Yeah, and I think that's where the value of, if you have access to like the sports psychologist or various things that can help you try and work on what you focus on, or at least how much attention you give it. Like I've been fortunate to have a few performance psychologists on the podcast, and one in particular, Jonah Oliver, that was talking about how he approaches performance psychology, and this is applicable. He's focusing not only on sports but business people, artists, whatever, is that sense of nervousness that we get, or anxiety or performance nerves, is very natural, and you actually shouldn't try to eliminate it because that's just a part of the process. And he compared it to lactic acid. And so he said to me, it was very clever, obviously, Grace, when you go to do a 2K rowing race, are you expecting lactic acid? I'm like, yeah, of course. And he's like, do you know it's going to hit? I'm like, well, yeah. And he goes, does that stop you from doing what you need to do? Does it slow you down? Or do you just continue and accept that that's going to be a part of it? I'm like, yeah, you can't stop lactic acid from happening. And he says, is it actually a sign that you're doing things well? Because if you don't get lactic acid, that means you haven't put your body in that state for where it like happens. And so he compared that to performance anxiety and performance nerves. So he goes, okay, so you know lactic acid's going to happen. You know it hurts, but it's not going to stop you. It's actually a sign of success that you're on the right, you're doing the right things, and you're going to push through it. Yeah. I was like, okay. And he's like, but you don't just push through it. You put it to the side. You just sort of acknowledge it's there and you build capacity around it. So if we think about that with performance anxiety, it's like, you know, it's going to happen. It's actually a part of the process. It's a sign that you're probably doing things right because you care and you're nervous about the results, etc. And it's not about trying to get rid of it, but just leave it where it is and then build capacity around it. So, okay, I acknowledge you. I know that you're there, but I've got such a larger capacity that I can continue and do the thing I need to do anyway. So in regards to anything, whether that's nerves or what our mind focuses on, etc. It's about building capacity so that you can acknowledge that's there and go, I see you, I recognize you, you're a part of the process, but I'm not going to let you stop me from doing what it is that I need to do.
First of all, I agree with like expecting the lactic acid and like you're pushing yourself. But I also, as you're telling that story, I was kind of thinking of like a theme that I came across with like the experts I talked to, and it's like resilience and athletes building resilience, learning how to be more comfortable with like, yeah, the pressures of being an athlete. And I think one of them is like performance, like performing on different test pieces. Also now learning like the sport specific pressures like that I've experienced in rowing, like other people in other sports also experience. And like even like moving away from home, like your network, like support network, like going to train at your college, a national team training center, like that builds a certain type of resilience that like having the capacity to do that takes a certain type of grit and motivation and discipline and all those things. But like, yeah. And also like if you have the ability to do something, that doesn't mean you can just do it.
Oh, I like that. So just because you can, you have the ability, doesn't mean it's going to happen. You still, what, like you still have to do it? What is that? Like, how do you interpret that?
Like just because you've gone fast before, like, how do I say this? Like, you have, like, your max effort and that, like, you could do, you could produce a certain speed and you have the ability to do it, but that doesn't mean, like, you always are able to do it and you always have the capacity. Like, in certain times of the year, like, you don't have capacity. Like, you just, like, have too much going on. You didn't eat well that day. You've got, like, a cold. You don't have to, like, PR, like, all the time. Like, you know, so just because you can go a certain speed, and you have the ability to do something, that doesn't mean it's going to happen, because sometimes you have the capacity and sometimes you don't. Like, we're not robots. Like, we're humans with emotions and things happen.
Other things that factor in, I think another person once described to me the high performance as the oscillation between your best performance, so your PRs, and your worst, quote unquote. And a high performance is about minimizing the drastic like change between that. So even if you have a really bad day, it's still pretty good. And there's not a drastic change between when you're at your best and when you're at your worst. I actually think Justin, our coach, mentioned something similar to that too. It's about like building up those abilities so that the gaps aren't too far apart. Okay, last serious question. Tall poppy talk, it's all about tall poppy syndrome, which is this thing more commonly experienced in Australia and New Zealand, where when we start to see successful people as they rise from the poppy field, we like chop them down. So first question is, how would you describe imposter syndrome, and then how have you interacted with it?
Okay, so how would I describe imposter syndrome? Okay, so I would describe it as a feeling of like not belonging or being good enough. In terms of myself, I think I experienced imposter syndrome the first time I made the U23-8 for Team USA. I remember feeling really unsure if I was going to make it. And even when I made it, I didn't really think it was real. So yeah, I think it took a minute to settle to that I made, because I made a really fast boat. Like that was the first like fast boat I had made for like a national team. I had a teammate, like I remember I had a teammate tell me that I like belonged in the boat, and that meant a lot to me. I remember
it does help to alleviate that sense of imposter syndrome, because you respect them and they respect you. And so that helps, I can imagine, feel more confident. But was that also, am I right in thinking that was the first time you were representing the USA as well?
No, I had done Kenemex for the US team a few years before.
But under 23s is a pretty big platform, and it's essentially the last step before senior national teams, right? I just find it relevant to call out for the listeners, like even someone who's making these national teams still experiences that and sees that in other people.
I think the way I've witnessed it is I've seen people like vocalize that they think they're the weak link. In that scenario, I think like someone feels like an imposter a little bit. And yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I like every person, even if like there isn't like a selection element, like, even if there aren't high stakes, like, every person in the boat is valuable and contributes. Like, so when someone says they're the weak link, like, it's just, I personally don't resonate or really agree. I do think, though, that, like, a lot of the time, whoever is the fastest on the erg gets, like, more recognition for that, which is, like, very valid, very true. But I think, like, whoever is, like, slower and like doesn't feel like they belong necessarily. Like everyone has like other things to contribute. Like, if it's not pure power and being the leader in like, you know, in the erg room, like there's other things you can add to. I never really like when people say, oh, I'm the weak link.
If you're not necessarily the strongest, like what else you can bring to the table or to the boat. I so agree with that. And I would always say like vibes make boats move fast, because if people feel trusted and supported in a boat and they feel like their teammates in the boat trust what they're doing, then you can focus and put your energy, talking about energy availability. You don't have enough energy to be worrying if someone else is doing their part. You just got to focus on what you're doing. But when you have confidence and trust in everyone in the boat and they know that you trust them, those vibes just add up. And if you're having fun, you are able to push yourself further, I really do believe. And I think that that makes quite a difference. So that's applicable to anything, right? Not just sport. It's like, if you feel like maybe you're not the, you know, most experienced or knowledgeable in an area, that's fine, because you can bring other stuff to the table as well.
Yeah. And actually, like, as I am like rowing, I've been rowing for like 7-8 years now. I'm starting to, you know, I'm like experienced, but like I also like know a little bit too much sometimes. And so actually I very much admire people who are like new to the sport and don't really know like how things, like what is the right way of doing, like, or pacing or whatever it is, like not knowing the difference between right and wrong all the time. That is such a great way to live in the sport sometimes. I wish I had that sometimes, because it makes it more enjoyable when you just don't know and you just don't have as many like expectations.
I like that you added that. Thank you. It's been so cool hearing what motivates you for the study, your experience with overtraining and imposter syndrome. And I'm very excited to see what not only the next year, but your career in rowing is going to bring. So you're, like I mentioned, even though you've been doing it for 7 or 8 years, you're still very young as a rower, which is exciting. But my sign-off question is so different, but if you had to listen to just one musical artist for the rest of your life, who's it going to be?
Okay, so for the rest of my life, yeah, I know, Khan.
I feel like that's going to make things hard for you in the erg room. Or could you erg to Noah Khan?
I think I could.
I used to sometimes like erg and work out to like quite slow songs or like country or something, because when you spend hours doing it, like you make your way through all the regular playlists, so you need some variety.
Yeah, I actually a couple weeks ago I erged with a teammate at Rutgers and we listened to country and it was great. And it was actually, Grace, it was not Steady State.
What was it?
And it was, and it, somehow it worked out just fine, and we had a great workout. So it was, and I never knew that I would be the type of person to like be able to do that, but yeah, it happened.
That is so funny. Well, Hannah, thank you for joining Tall Poppy Talk today. Really exciting stuff, just getting started, so we'll have you on the podcast again at some point. Oh. And we'll see what else you've been up to, but thank you for spending the time with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. It's just so fun.
Thank you so much for listening to Tall Poppy Talk. We'll see you next time. Feel free to check us out on socials.